Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is California's Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. Sponsored by Assemblymembers Tom Amiano and V. Manuel Perez, the bill, officially known as AB 889, would establish new rules governing the wages, hours, and working conditions of the estimated 200,000 Californians who work as nannies, housekeepers, and in-home attendants for the elderly and disabled. Overwhelmingly women and foreign-born, domestic workers, as supporters point out, often labor in isolation, leaving them vulnerable to exploitation, discrimination, and abuse, and unable to advocate collectively for better working conditions. By closing loopholes that have excluded these workers from protective labor laws, supporters say, the bill, in mandating basic benefits such as overtime pay, rest breaks, and the right to sue over unlawful employment practices, will go a long way towards greater equality for domestic workers. But to those who oppose the bill, as it's written, they say it has negative unintended consequences or the potential for such, as other vulnerable populations may be affected. Namely, the hundreds of thousands of elderly and disabled citizens who may no longer be able to afford quality in-home care, they say. And so tonight, we're bringing both sides of the conversation together to ask a couple of crucial questions. Can AB 889, as it's written, balance the needs of these two constituencies? And what do employers and employees alike need to know about the bill? So we're going to start our conversation tonight with one of the sponsors of the bill, Assemblymember Tom Amiano. He represents San Francisco and the 13th Assembly District. And then we'll move on to several other guests who I'll introduce in a moment. But first, Assemblymember Tom Amiano, welcome to the program. Okay, we're going to get Assemblymember Amiano back on the air in just a moment, but this gives me an opportunity to introduce our other guests tonight. We're also joined by Gracia Lima. She's campaign director of the California Domestic Workers Coalition. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Joseph.
And we're also joined by Maria Ontiveros. She's professor of employment law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, where she focuses on immigrant workers' rights. Welcome, Professor Ontiveros.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're also joined here by Andy Howard. He's CEO of Home Care Professionals, an in-home care placement agency based in Daly City.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So actually, I'm going to start with you, Professor Ontiveros, if you wouldn't mind. From your understanding of the bill, could you outline what are some of the basic rights and who do they apply to?
Well, right now, we have a variety of different rights that apply to domestic workers. Domestic workers could be anybody who works within a home. And there is right now a variety of different levels of rights depending upon the type of work that different domestic workers do. So what this bill seeks to do, as it, according to its sponsors, is to try and level the playing field so that all domestic workers are treated the same. So, for instance, right now, all domestic workers within California are guaranteed the right to a minimum wage. However, certain workers, domestic workers, are not guaranteed a right to overtime, rest breaks, or meal breaks. And those are the domestic workers who are personal attendants.
Okay, so you're saying that this bill is trying to extend to domestic workers some of the rights that workers in other camps have been able to make use of and sort of, as you say, level the playing field.
Yes, indeed. And to make it clear that all domestic workers have the same coverage, because right now the law is confusing and different types of domestic workers have different requirements.
Okay, so I hear that we have Assemblymember Tom Amiano on the line. Is that correct?
I'm here. Where are you? You need to turn.
Oh, there you are. All right. You're here. You've been here the whole time, huh?
Girl, your gaydar needs to be stronger here.
Well, I've really been enjoying it.
I liked your introductory remarks, too. I thought you really captured it.
Well, wonderful. Well, it's great to have you on the program. So I know we only have about, 2 minutes of your time at this point. let's go ahead and ask you to tell us and the listeners what inspired you to sponsor this bill.
Well, you know, I taught school in San Francisco for a very long time, over 25 years, and public school in the Mission District, and I saw a lot of the parents, particularly the mothers, performing these kind of services, this was in the 70s, you can imagine, for really, really low compensation. And I often felt when I was waiting with a kid because the mom was late because, you know, one of the employers wanted her to stay later to do some menial task. This was out of balance. This was out of whack. It felt like indentured servitude, not like employment. And so I've always carried that with me. And of course, you know, you occasionally have a solar sunspot, and that happened with Meg Whitman and her domestic worker and Nikki Miramontes, and that kind of focused it for me. And so I've been working with a bunch of really wonderful advocates statewide, to try to get at least a minimum rights for people, because we're all in the bigger context, because we're all starved for the things that should come to us. There's always, I want my piece of the pie, or they people, you know, try to put other people against each other. So in this case, the disability community has, quite a number of concerns, and they have not been treated well, by the state government. And I get it. But either have these mostly women. So yes, it has been a lot of compromise. We are continuing to do that. I'm from New Jersey, so I tend to be cynical, but I feel that we're going to find a common ground before this is all over. And I think that's very heartening because, the disability community, like all our communities, is not monolithic. And there's different opinions about how this will work. We've had many members of the disability community. My own godson, Jake Buxton, who I think works for you guys, testifying about why we need this bill. So I feel we will come to a resolve. I think we're smarter, both the disability community and those of us who want the labor rights. I think we're smarter than those that pit us against each other, and we'll get there.
So, Assemblyman Amiano, could you tell us what are areas that you would be open to looking at more?
Well, that is going to happen with the two communities, but I'll tell you what we have done. We've taken out the sick days. We've reduced the hours. We're talking about what happens when people, stay overnight. There's been some issues there. Those coming together, so to speak, have heartened other discussions so further. So what they particularly are, I think they probably revolve around cost and, compensation. But there's been a lot of give and take. So I'm going to go on record and saying that I am hopeful.
Okay. Would you say that there's any sort of hard bottom lines that you won't negotiate?
I don't want to commit to anything like that. It feels like the Republican candidate where they don't want to say anything. But I think I don't want to betray any trust. I think there is a positive outcome that's within reach.
Because I know you have to go, my understanding is that this bill passed the assembly twice, and it didn't pass the Senate the first time, and now it's kind of on hold again in the Senate. What's up with that?
No, that's a good thing. It's all inside baseball, so I'm not going to bore you. But getting out of the assembly was a great thing. And it's all about appropriations and budget. So we're in the Senate now. We haven't been there before. And we agreed to have it held in appropriations, which is a committee that holds a lot of bills. With a commitment to work with all the stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening. So basically, we're given shelter.
Okay.
If we get it to the Senate floor, then off the Senate floor, then to the governor's desk.
Is the fact that some are concerned that if this bill becomes law, that it'll put a burden on the state to have to find funds to enforce the law in a time when we're strapped for cash as a state? Is that what's holding this up?
That's a little defeatist in my book. You know, the state has a lot of tricks up its sleeve, and I'm beginning to learn all those. It's too bad that there's term limits. But there's quite many avenues to come to the goal that we wish. So I don't find that an obstacle. Otherwise, we would just be running in place.
Okay. Any last thoughts or comments before we send you off?
The Italians say coraggio. Yeah, you know, I know who's going to win the Republican nomination for president.
Of course, you've set me up there. I have to ask you. Who?
The white guy. All right.
Very good. Very good. Okay, Assemblymember Tom Omiano, thanks for joining us. All right. Well, interesting way to transition our conversation. And I actually want to just check in and see if our other phone guest, Joe Hafkenschiel, is on the line. Are you there, Joe?
I am here.
Okay, excellent. Well, we had a bumpy start, but it sounds like we're going to smooth things out. Well, we'll see where the conversation goes. Anyway, I want to reintroduce the program since we were a little bumpy at the beginning. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're also on the web at kalw.org. And tonight we're talking about California's Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. And we just heard there from Assemblymember Tom Omiano, who is a co-sponsor of the bill, also known or officially known as AB 889. And what it does is it tries to extend to domestic workers rights in terms of compensation and working conditions and recourse if those working conditions and are not met, rights that were not available to them or are not available to them at this point. And so we're going to open the conversation now to several voices here who are looking at this from a couple of different sides. Maria Ontiveros is a professor of employment law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. And then we also have Andy Howard. He's CEO of Home Care Professionals, an in-home care placement agency based in Daly City. On the phone just a second ago there was Joe Hafkenschiel weighing in, who's president of the California Association of Health for Health Services at Home, a statewide organization representing the in-home care industry. And we also have here in the studio Grecia Lima. She's campaign director for the California Domestic Workers Coalition. 415-841-4134 is the number to call to join our conversation tonight. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And we've also already had a couple of emails come in, so please go ahead and email now or post on our Facebook page now, and then we'll open the phones in about 5 to 10 minutes. So back to you, Professor Ontiveros, because I think we haven't gotten the full scope of this bill. So you talked about some of the privileges that would be available if passed.
Actually, if it's possible, I would like to make a bigger picture.
Absolutely.
Transition, which is, I think that we need to look at the California Domestic Workers Bill of Rights with the historical context in mind. In the 1930s, when the National Labor Relations Act was passed.
By the way, this is Grecia Lima who's speaking, so that we're not attributing your comments to Professor Ontiveros. Go ahead.
So in the 1930s, when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, which is the bill that actually gave most of the basic labor protections to a lot of the workers, like overtime, mealtime, rest break, Southern senators would not sign a bill that would threaten the racial hierarchy of the South. And at that time, the two major and predominantly African-American industries was domestic workers and farm workers. So as a concession to these Southern senators, they decided to specifically exclude domestic workers and farm workers from really basic labor protections. You fast forward this 75 years later, and we're still standing on the outdated exclusion of this law. So what the California Domestic Workers Bill of Rights is trying to do is to extend the same basic labor protections that all other workers enjoy, like overtime, mealtime, rest break, to this very vulnerable and critical industry in California.
Great. Well, I really appreciate how succinctly you put that in terms of giving us a sense of the context in which this bill has emerged. So that was Gracia Lima, the campaign director for the California Domestic Workers Coalition, and I want to hear more from you in just a moment. I'm going to turn back to Professor Ontiveros now and ask, so we've outlined what's covered in terms of protections. Now, who's covered that may have not been covered before or is not covered currently?
The main extension really is in terms of those domestic workers who are personal attendants, who were not protected before by overtime, rest periods, and meal periods. In addition, all domestic workers, whether or not they're personal attendants or whether or not they're house cleaners, whether or not they're a variety of other things, are now going to be protected with things, for instance, with record keeping, so that they will be given an indication of how many hours they've worked and what has been paid into taxes. There will also be some changes in terms of workers' compensation so that if there are injuries on the job, that there is a guarantee that there's a way that those are going to be compensated for. And then in addition, differences in terms of making sure that the very sticky issue of sleeping time for people who are working in home for 24 hours at a time is also dealt with. So basically knowing what your rights are in terms of the record keeping, overtime, rest, meal periods, workers' compensation, and sleeping time are really many of the core things being addressed in the bill.
And how about recourse for if these conditions are not met? Is that something new as well, or is that once it just comes with the package of rights?
No, not it just comes with the package of rights. One of the things that workers have, once they have a basic right, they have some way to go and enforce it. And they also have a place to bargain from. So the bill, as I understand it, and especially the negotiations that that Mr. Amiano referred to that are ongoing, have to do with the ability of the employees and the employer to negotiate various ways, for instance, to cover meal periods. But if the worker does not have the basic right for a meal period to begin with, that's a very different bargaining position to start from than if you don't have that as a legal right.
Okay. So is there anyone exempt from this?
Yes. IHSS workers.
Okay, in-home support services workers.
In-home support services, developmental disability services too. And we felt that it was important to exclude those two communities because they are the lowest income earners of the disability rights.
You mean the employers,
right,
so to speak?
I'm sorry. Yes,
right,
employers.
Right. And my understanding is family members and babysitters under 18.
Okay. And it's likely that after these negotiations are ongoing, the very occasional babysitter who's even over 18 will probably also be excluded because that's been a real flashpoint. Mm. That doesn't really address the key issues.
Casual babysitters are out of the bill.
Okay. And how about from the employer standpoint? Does it matter who the employer is? So if it's a private home that's employing someone versus an agency, or there's a certain threshold number of employees, for example?
No, everybody is covered. And to a large extent, everybody is covered now. If you have a nanny, you have a requirement to be paying taxes. You have a requirement to be paying workers' compensation. It may be that people don't realize that, but there's not a big extension in terms of the employer side of the board.
So, okay. So these are things that perhaps people are not aware of, or perhaps are not just basically not doing. But you're saying that there's some additional category, which is the in-home attendants that have been added to the group of workers who are to be protected by the rights of this bill.
By certain portions of the bill where they are currently excluded, primarily around overtime, rest periods, and meal periods.
Okay.
And then the other protections are for all domestic workers.
And so that we actually kind of nailed this down. Let's go through that one at a time. So employers must pay overtime. So what does that mean?
It means time and a half for workers who work more than 40 hours a week.
No.
And
I'm sorry.
Yes.
It's time and a half for workers that work more than 8 hours daily.
Okay.
And double time for our workers that work 12 hours.
Okay.
More than 12 hours daily.
And overtime for workers who work more than 40 hours in a given work week.
Okay. And then how about the breaks provision?
It's very simple. You sit for half an hour if you have worked more than 4 hours, and you have the actually the flexibility already on the bill that you can eat while you're working. And then the rest breaks are also like any other worker has, a 15-minute break, and it's required on the premises just like any other worker has it too.
Okay. And in terms of the sleep provision for live-in workers?
The sleep provision is actually, if you look closely at the bill, it's actually a flexibility within the bill. What we're actually asking and telling people is that workers are required to stay on the premises without being paid, which if you think about it, you're still under the control of the employer. But we are creating the flexibility that they will not be paid for those 8 hours.
It's 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep, as they say.
Yeah.
Which we'll have some comments in just a moment from Andy and Joe to talk about how they are concerned that these conditions would affect the those who benefit from these services, how it would affect them. So workers' comp, that's pretty straightforward. There's kind of a one-size-fits-all around that, right? And then this employer...
Yes, and the only thing I would say is that oftentimes a homeowner's policy will cover the workers' compensation okay. for the employer who has that sort of a policy.
And the wage reporting, is that new?
It is new in terms of giving the information. If you employed someone before, you had to keep track of that. Mm. But now the actual being able to have the right to be handed something that says what your hours are and what the deductions are. And you know what? There's an app for that.
There's of course there is.
To try and make it easy, the Department of Labor has recently come out with an app for that.
And Grecia, I want to follow up with you on that issue. Wage reporting, that sounds like, why is that such a big deal? Or it could be really cumbersome for a private home to have to start reporting wages. Why is that important to you and the people that you work with and in support of this bill?
I think that what we're seeing is that all other workers are enjoying this rights. If you look at somebody who works in an undisclosed coffee shop or in Kinko's or any other industry, you see that they have those same basic protections. So if we are extending something like pay stubs and overtime to workers that perform necessary duties, why are we not extending it to the people that care for the most precious things of our lives, mm-hmm. which are our families, our caregivers, our family members, people that we love and trust? I think that it says a lot. And the confusion that is coming from the bill, I think it's coming more from a place that we really can't believe that it's 2012, mm-hmm. 75 years later, and that there's still workers are still excluded from really basic labor protections.
And my understanding is the other issue or the other reason for reporting wages is to make sure that employees know that they actually are being paid for the hours worked. And sometimes if you don't have something that shows how that dollar figure was arrived at, you can't quite tell. Is that true as well, Professor Ontiveros?
Yes, that's also true. It is just a basic communication, and it is a way of making it clear to everybody how many hours there actually are, because it may very well be that an employer has in his or her mind that their domestic worker is there for a set period of time, but that once they actually look at the clock and realize the days that get where either the worker may come in late or the worker may end up staying much later because of an emergency, that the hours might be more than what even a good employer expects that they're paying. So once you get it all on paper, it becomes clearer to everybody what the work situation really is.
Okay. And I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing California's Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, officially known as AB 889, with our guest Grecia Lima. She's campaign director for the California Domestic Workers Coalition. Maria Ontiveros, professor of employment law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. We heard a little earlier at the top of the hour from Tom Amiano. He's an assembly member for San Francisco and the 13th Congressional District. And then we also are going to hear in just a moment from Andy Howard, CEO of Home Care Professionals, and Joe Hafkenshield, president of the California Association for Health services at home. We invite you, our listeners, to dial in to 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 to join our conversation this evening. Are you an employer of a domestic worker? Are you a domestic worker? Call in with your perspective on this bill. 415-841-4134. You can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post something on a comment on our Facebook page. So, Andy Howard, CEO of Home Care Professionals, I wanted to get you into the conversation now to have you encapsulate for us the concerns that you and others in your industry have about this bill.
Sure. Thank you. You know, I support the things that Gracie was talking about. You know, I work with domestic workers every day. I hear their horror stories. I see how it affects their lives. And the concept of this bill is a good one. Protecting domestic workers. We need to ensure they have a professional and safe environment in which to work. We need to ensure that they make a fair and decent wage. So I support laws that enable that. The problem with 889 is not the concept, but rather the content of this bill. And when you look at what it says and what it will do in effect, it will actually hurt a lot of the domestic workers who work in the home care field, and it will hurt them by decreasing their wages and or forcing them to take jobs that are under the table.
Why is that?
Well, and I'll get into that. Let me make my second point quickly here. The other problem with the way 889 is written is it will really hurt, if not devastate, the thousands and thousands of sick, elderly, and disabled Californians who depend upon home care to remain living in their homes. And for those reasons, that is why myself and other people who work in the industry are very against this. But to get back to your question, why, it's a pretty basic principle. And it's basically, if a service costs so much that no one is able or willing to afford it, then the job providing the service simply will cease to exist. And that's what happens with 889 when you look at how it impacts the cost of in-home care. What most people don't realize, in-home care is an out-of-pocket expense. It's not covered by Medicare. It's not covered by Medi-Cal. It's something that people literally often are spending their life savings on. And if you look, and we can go through the numbers. I have spreadsheets here. I don't know how detailed we want to get. But if you look at the way, specifically what's called live-in care, which is basically, caregivers living on a daily rate. They're not paid hourly. They're paid by the day. And usually, two caregivers care for one patient over the course of a seven-day week. If you were to provide that same service under the terms required by 889, you're talking a 3x price increase. Just to give you a quick number, in California, the average live-in care costs about $250 a day right now for a patient. Well, it would go to $680 a day per 889. Now, I don't think that's the intent of 889, but that's the reality as it's written for the exact same service that someone's getting today. And at that price point, it simply becomes unaffordable. So what do people do who need in-home care? Because these are people, if they can't have in-home care, they cannot live at home. So their options are basically two. One is to move into an institution, and most people desperately want to avoid that. Which, by the way, that will impact the state down the road because that's eventually going to cost the state, which we all know the state healthcare budget is getting smaller and smaller by the day, not expanding. The other option is they will hire people under the table. There's a lot of problems with that scenario, and this under-the-table employment relationship, this is where all these horror stories you hear about these domestic workers who are being abused by their employers, that's where that's happening. It's not happening, by and large, it's not happening with the above-the-board legitimate employment companies, but it's happening in these private settings where, like we were saying, the people, they're ignorant of the labor laws, and whether they are blissfully ignorant or intentionally ignorant, who knows, but that's where the abuses are happening.
So I want to get to Joe Hack and shield, just because I want to make sure we get you in here since you're on the phone, so before we get comments from the other side. Joe, is there anything you wanted to add about your concerns about this bill, or ways to kind of understand the differences between the vulnerabilities that exist on each side here, the vulnerabilities of the in your case, the elderly, disabled folks that domestic workers, live-in workers often can help, and the vulnerabilities of workers who, as Grecia has said, have been excluded for decades from the same basic employment protections that others have had for a very long time?
Well, just a couple of points. First, this bill is called the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights, and the implication is that domestic workers don't have rights under California law, and that is completely incorrect. Domestic workers are currently covered by something called Wage Order 15. They have a guaranteed minimum wage. They have a right to overtime, meal periods, and break periods. So kind of the threshold question is, what is the need for this bill, given that they're currently covered under the law? The second point to make is that Assemblymember Amiano said that this legislation is patterned after legislation in New York, and the legislation in New York exempted agencies and the workers employed by them. And that's the only thing we're asking of Mr. Amiano now, is exempt agencies that employ these workers, and will support the bill.
But that basically cuts out all the workers who work in agencies like Andy's.
That's correct.
So you're basically trying to exclude the group that this bill is basically trying to bring into the present with in alignment with other workers' rights.
No, we're not. The distinction is between a domestic worker, someone who works in someone's home, who is currently covered, and then a relatively narrow subcategory of that, which is a personal attendant. And a personal attendant is someone who provides care and companionship to the elderly and the disabled. And that's the only subgroup that we're trying to exclude from the law. And that subgroup has been excluded under California law and regulation and under federal law and regulation for the last 20 or 30 years. And the reason for that is to strike a balance between paying the worker a living wage and keeping the care affordable for the elderly and the disabled.
Okay, thanks very much there. 415-841-4134, feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or post a comment on our Facebook page to join our conversation tonight about the California Domestic Workers' Rights Bill here on City Visions on KALW. And so now I want to turn back to Grecia Lima, who is the campaign director for the California Domestic Workers Coalition, for some of your reactions to what you heard from Joe Hafkenshiel, the president of the California Association for Healthcare Services at Home, Health Services at Home, and Andy Howard, CEO of Home Care Professionals.
Yeah. I think that something that we can agree is that domestic workers feel really strongly about protecting the people that they actually care about, because they care for the seniors, they care for the elderly, they are the ones bathing them, feeding them, turning them over in their beds. And I think that intent to try to look out for this industry is very real. This is the second fastest growing industry assigned by the Department of Labor. And I really like Joan's comments, because it shows the proposals that they're putting forward. What I hear is that they say agencies are saying now that domestic workers are already included in this bill, so why should we include them? If domestic workers were...
They're included in protections that already
right,
exist.
In protections
right.
that already mm-hmm. exist. If they were already included in protections that we already exist, then why are we having a discussion about you know, just extending the same basic labor protections that other workers have. Third-party agencies were excluded from the New York bill, and that's because in New York, third-party agencies are already paying overtime. They're supposed to be paying overtime under the law. So the difference between California and New York law was that New York actually had already protected domestic workers in overtime protections, mealtime and rest breaks in New York long before the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights came along. So they actually didn't needed to include third-party agencies in that. And I think what I invite our opponents is that we've heard this argument about cost time and time again. And if we're going to talk about numbers, what we're talking about is if we are thinking about somebody who works an eight-hour day and they have to stay two more hours, then and they are paid $15 an hour. That is a $10 extra hour. That is 2 hours that person was not planning on staying over, that they missed the bus, that they missed their families. So we are very committed to working flexibility on our bill. But we also need to recognize that these workers are doing incredibly important work. They are the backbone of our California's economy. They are the workers that allowed other workers go and do their jobs. And I think that what we're asking is not a handout. They're asking for the same labor protections that any other worker has.
So Maria Ontiveros, back to you then. So if it's just as Grecia says, it's about the basic rights that these workers are due to them, and on the other side, this is going to break the banks these disabled individuals. What do you think of the calculations? What do you think about this argument that, I mean, because at the end of the day, that's the issue that has to be wrestled with, right? Or is that not the way to frame this debate?
I think that certainly is the issue that has to be wrestled with. But I think that what it means is that it makes us as a society recognize how costly it is to provide care for our elderly, for our children. It brings the real costs of that home, because otherwise, if you're saying that we're going to pay the people who do that work below the floor that we've set for workers, before what we have said, this is the right that workers have to be paid. These are the minimum wage conditions or the minimum employment conditions that we have, that is a decision that we make as a society, that it would be okay. And it's clearly not, because we say these are the basic bottom, the minimum floor that everybody needs to have who is a worker. I think that what this can do is provide us the opportunity, as Mr. Amiano talked about, to start building coalitions, to recognize that the caregivers and the people who need the care have a lot of the same interest, which is to make sure that those caregivers are well-rested enough to provide good care, that they are paid a decent wage, that they can really be fully focused on providing the care that they need to. And by making the cost real, perhaps it will then provide more political traction for both of these groups to come together to try to have better care for everybody.
And what could you see as a way forward in what could otherwise appear as a stalemate between these two sides?
Well, one thing, and you know, certainly Andy can have an opportunity to talk more about his calculations, is when you see that huge increase, perhaps that means that you're assuming that you're going to continue with a two-person rotation of people each working 12 hours, as opposed to having three people working 8 hours each, which would decrease the overtime cost substantially. Now, that's a trade-off in terms of the number of caregivers, the number of people who are in the home. But on the other hand, there are a lot of studies that talk about the decline in quality of care that goes once you have to be working more than 8 hours. So there are certainly ways to work with the staffing to address some of those cost concerns.
Yeah, and what I would say, and I think you're right on, Professor, yes, it's an option to have three workers working 8-hour shifts. But what you're doing in that scenario is you're essentially turning someone's private home into a nursing home. There's a revolving door of caregivers coming in. And keep in mind, because of the 40-hour week limitation of 889, you're going to have two teams of three people covering 7 days a week. But then you're going to have at least three, if not six more people, coming in to provide breaks to the first six people. So you have a scenario where you have 12 people coming in to care for a client who might have Alzheimer's, might have dementia. I mean, that's unworkable right from step one. Whether it's the family paying for it or the client paying for it, they're simply not going to pay for that. It's going to destroy continuity of care, as you mentioned. That's not the way you build a caring relationship between client and patient. So it's possible in theory. And by the way, even having three people working at hour shifts, I have a lot of calculations here on my spreadsheet, so bear with me.
To the bottom line. Yeah, we have a couple of calls coming in.
Okay. You're still going to be looking at an increased cost of what it costs today for live-in home care. So
okay. Actually, this quickly reminds me of the debate that's happened in some other labor markets that have always had carve-outs in the past. For example, medical trainees. And there's been recent changes in the law in the last year that requires medical trainees to get a certain number of hours of rest and curtails their shifts. Some of the same concerns came up at those discussions, where the more handoffs you have, the more concerns you have about missing situations or these continuities of care. But at the end of the day, the regulation came down that we need to give these doctors in training rest as well. So it's an interesting question to see how this is happening in other labor markets, so to speak, as well. So I want to get to a phone call. Let's go to Sam from Torrance. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on this show. I really appreciate that. Speaking of the minimum wages, we already have the minimum wages protecting the domestic workers. Yet we hear all the horror stories about a lot of domestic workers not being paid the minimum wages. So I wonder if the issue on hand that we should be addressing is implementation of the law that we already have on hand, or do we need a new law that's just a duplicate of that we already have.
Or perhaps maybe what you're saying there, Sam, also is adding more more conditions that perhaps won't get enforced either. Is that where you're going?
That's what I'm saying. We have the law that protects the domestic workers, yet we hear all the stories about they're not being paid the minimum wages, and which is true, because I recently hired two caregivers who in the previous company were being paid about $4 an hour. So it's true that they are not getting the minimum wages with all the employers. So we do have a situation of violation of the law that's already in place. Rather than implementing that properly, why are we seeking to bring in more and more new laws, which is on a repetitive scale? I mean, I don't think you're seeing anything new. It's just that you're trying to bring in more and more new laws.
Okay. Thanks very much, Sam, for your call. And it looks like both Andy here and Maria have responses. Andy, you go first.
Yeah, I think that's a great point the caller made. Two things along those lines. One is, he's absolutely right. The current laws are not being implemented, but if you look at, and now I'm going to forget because I'm thinking about my second point, which, anyway, Maria, why don't you go, and I'll reformulate my point here. Sorry about that.
Yeah. The point that I was going to make is that one of the reasons why there is such an under-the-table economy for this is because there is the historical background of saying that domestic work is different than other types of work, and that it is okay to treat these workers differently. If you regularize it, if you say domestic workers have the same rights that all the other workers have, and that they're no longer excluded for the race-based reasons that they were excluded originally, then you begin to recognize the fact that these are workers who should be treated fairly. That then becomes a very important educational point, so that everyone starts to know this is not an underground economy anymore. It is part of the regular economy, and it can provide a springboard to enforce the existing laws better.
And I'm going to let you come in here, Grecia, but I want to get back to this issue, though. If putting laws on the books that are going to continue to be perhaps flouted, you know, not what's the point, but sort of how do you tackle that, too? Grecia.
And with that, I just wanted to add that I think it's showing that today, or that now, is the point we're also seeing changes to the definition of companionship at the federal level. So we're starting to see that the movement that domestic workers are building by sharing their stories, speaking out, and really asking for them to be treated, just like Maria said, as any other worker is treated, is actually springboarding into a national movement that is recognizing that domestic workers are not companions. They are professional, standardized workers. And I think that this issue of enforcement, I think it usually comes about when we're talking about something that is, we're afraid of change. We've done this so many years in the same way. Why should we change it now? And I think that we don't talk about enforcement for other bills and for other issues that they're really difficult to enforce. How do you enforce privacy protections on the internet? What our companies are doing? And we're not talking about enforcement there, but we are specifically talking about enforcement now. And a lot of the comments, and I think a lot of the at core issue is that we have done this for so many years the same way, that we're so afraid of change. And change is uncomfortable, and change, it's about having these conversations and building on those flexibilities, but it's also about having equality. And I think that we can all agree that these workers, what they're doing is actually really important work, and they should be treated just like any other worker.
And so what you're saying is ability to enforce or not doesn't mean that these laws shouldn't be on the books in the first place.
Absolutely.
And going back to you Andy.
Yeah, the second point the caller made about how he hired two caregivers from another, that in another employment situation had been being paid $4 an hour, that really highlights one of the problems here in California, and that is there is no licensure for non-medical in-home care caregivers. And because there's no licensure, there's no standards. You have all these companies operating with different modus operandi. There is a licensure bill, coincidentally, right now going through the government, but it's a very ill-conceived licensure bill. But New York, for example, who, again, they did exempt the third-party employer, they have licensure in that state. And I would argue one of the reasons they exempt is because home care is already a licensed industry in that state, whereas here it's not. And you can set a lot of the minimum standards and protection for workers in place by a licensure level rather than the free-for-all that exists here in California.
Hmm. I want to go to an email from Denise, who says AB 889 will make home care less effective and more expensive. 889 would remove the flexibility needed to provide quality care at an affordable price, and it would prevent caregivers who provide 24-hour care from working the shifts they prefer. AB 889 will make home care less effective and more expensive to ensure patients and families have access to the home care they need at an affordable price. The public and legislature should reject AB 889. I want to get to a couple of sort of little points that maybe not so little. How does this bill affect employment of undocumented workers?
It's just like the law, labor law in California, regardless of your immigration status, you're covered by California labor law.
And this idea of needing a social security number in order to report wages, how is that going to work with an undocumented worker?
Well, currently, employers are not supposed to employ undocumented workers. So that doesn't change. However, if an employer is employing an undocumented worker, there are certain rights that you get as a worker, period. And they come because you are there giving of yourself as in terms of your human capital as a worker, and you have those rights as a worker whether you're documented or not. But an employer is not supposed to be employing undocumented workers.
Okay. And with all due respect, though, what's the recourse that an undocumented worker can take if they're concerned about their immigration status being brought into question if they come forward to report abuses by their employer?
They would have the same legal recourse as any other worker would have if they would choose to use them. Yeah.
Right. They're certainly more vulnerable. They're less likely to report. It is more difficult to report. Many enforcement agencies do not ask about immigration status because they want to have the labor laws enforced. Other enforcement agencies are more concerned about the immigration laws and focus on that as a priority. So it really depends upon the particular situation.
Hmm. My understanding from when speaking with Assemblymember Amiano earlier in the program is that there are certain things that got taken out, such as sick days, and that it was or paid time off, whether vacation days or not. Why did those go, and how do you feel, Grecia, about the fact that those went?
I think that we came in with the understanding, actually this bill was written out of the stories and out of a survey by domestic workers for domestic workers. So when we came in with the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, we had an ambitious bill that was trying to encompass a lot of the main concerns of the actual industry, and it was coming directly from the workers. So when we came in, we went in with the full understanding that what we were going to put forward was not everything that we were going to get. I think right now we have a really strong bill that is trying to bring equality to the industry and standardize it. And really, I think another point that I don't think we have been able to make, and it's about the employers. Like, employers are one of our biggest supporters in the bill. We have employers that go every time we go to Sacramento, they, you know, ride the bus with us for 2 to 5 hours. And
why are employers supporting you?
Employers are supporting us because the law is really confusing. It's really hard for employers to understand. I have the best example. It's Nikki. She is an employer who she started hiring personal attendants at the age of 18, and she always says, when I was 18, I was not ready to hire a worker. And I wish that somebody would have been there to tell me what to, how to treat my worker. Do I give them rest breaks? Do I give them bonuses? What are the standard practices for me to be able to hire a worker? And looking, you know, Nikki's not 18 anymore. She is actually PhD, you know, so she's not 18. And yet she comes with us every time because she feels that if employers knew, how is it that we create standardized rules for these workers, that we will have better quality care, that there won't be turnover. One of the biggest causes that we have for domestic workers in the industry right now is actually because of turnover. Workers, every time that you have to step off work and find somebody to care for your children, to care for your senior mother or father, to care for somebody that you cannot absolutely care because you have a job, it's actually money that is being lost. So what we're creating is actually creating an industry that is going to have way more balance than it is now. And another thing is that New York was able to pass this bill and enforce this bill. And agencies and individual employers are paying overtime. So I think that every other worker is being paid overtime. But if you care for a senior with stage 2 Alzheimer, they're not. How is that fair?
And I'm going to get Andy and Joe here in a moment. Other things that are not noted in this bill are there's no access to health care, although that's not part of any other fair labor practices either. But there's nothing around OSH regulations or safe working condition regulations that there are in other places. Was that too much to try to put in this bill, or is that sort of the next wave?
I'm sorry.
Very briefly.
Can you repeat
that? The question is around
occupational
safety and health.
Sorry,
which was in the original bill. There were concerns about the cost of that and how that would drive costs up.
So that was actually in the original
bill. That was in the original bill. It was taken out. That's my understanding.
Okay.
Because domestic work is very physically demanding. There's a lot of injuries that occur, so it is an ongoing concern for workers, and I think that's why it was in the original bill.
Okay.
And also, just to correct you real quickly on that point, in San Francisco, any caregiver who's employed legally is covered by the Health Care Security Ordinance, which
of course Tom Amiano, if he could call me back right now and yell at me, he would do that.
That's right.
Okay, so so Andy, just because we have like less than 5 minutes in the program, what would you say are places or ways without getting rid of this grouping from the law completely, are there any other places you could see some fixes here that could make this more palatable to your industry?
What I think the proponents of this bill still don't grasp is the way live-in care works. And if you want to mandate a wage overtime, double time, you have to make an exception for live-in. And maybe you make a minimum daily compensated amount for live-in, but simply put, I mean, whether you know, the first number I gave was with two people doing the same thing. But even if you had one person and then you send another person to cover that person while they sleep at night, you're still talking a cost of over $200,000 a year. That's simply unaffordable. So you talk about trying to stabilize the industry. I mean, it's going to do the exact opposite. This industry exists for one reason. Because people are willing to pay for the service to get help in their homes.
So you're holding the line here that this just really can't work.
I don't see how. I mean, the overtime for someone who's working a 10-hour shift, that's not such a big deal because it has a very small cost impact to the client. But the live-in care is what's, I mean, that is the line in the sand. I don't see how this will work.
And you get the final word, Professor Ontiveros, which is how is recent pronouncements by President Obama signaling that there might be some federal movement on this issue that either may supersede or you know, make this conversation sort of obsolete at some point?
Well, it won't really affect us because California is already more protective than the federal labor law. Currently, under federal law, there is no minimum wage, for instance, that is guaranteed to domestic workers. However, in California, we have that. So that would be a shift, but it wouldn't affect us in that regard.
Hmm. And Joe, actually, sorry, I forgot to get you in there. Any last thoughts that you have on this topic? Very quickly.
Too quickly. Number one, I believe Gresham is wrong that in New York, overtime is not paid to companions. And I verified that with a colleague a couple of days ago. And secondly, personal attendant in California is paid from $128 to $192 a day. If that person's hours are reduced to 8, their daily wage is going to decline to $64. So, like Andy said earlier, workers could actually lose from this legislation.
Okay, but it sounds like everyone is concerned that this move forward at some point, and it's unclear how that's actually going to be resolved. But Assemblymember Amiano was very hopeful that could happen. And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Assemblymember Tom Amiano, Gracia Lima, Campaign Director for the California Domestic Workers Coalition, Andy Howard, CEO of Home Care Professionals, Maria Ontiveros, Professor of Employment Law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and Joe Hafkenschiel, President of the California Association for Health Services at Home. Thanks to all of you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our new web portal. Just go to kalw.org and search for City Visions. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. City Vision's senior producer is Judith Sansone, and Neil Friess manages our website. My co-host Lauren Metzler will be here next Monday. This is Joseph Pache. Good night and have a great week.